to torment and escape. But for others, those who are perhaps serious about their work, a substitute is a source of chagrin. And of course, Jeff is the master of these books of the Old Testament, so I'm just going to do the best I can to fill in. As I'm not even sure where he is. Anybody know where Jeff went? I knew he was doing good work somewhere, so doing the work of the kingdom, so we're glad for that, and we'll fill in here. I haven't been part of your class, so I'm going to ask for help. I'm actually listed as the teacher for the class on grief, but in one of my most brilliant teaching moves, I turned it over to someone else, and I haven't taught for 4 weeks in there. This is the fourth week. David Pickup is doing an astonishing work in there right now. So I can be here. And we're looking at Kings, and I was given this assignment. Jeff asked me to cover three chapters tonight somehow, so we're going to consider those chapters to get you to that point where he can start that Elijah-Elisha cycle, as he referred to it. So that's our job, is to get us to that point. And we're going to explore. But I do ask you to think all the way through this, how to kind of take this on the road. What in this changes my thinking so that I can change my doing and live better? I think we can do that. Now, we'll have to work at it, so that's where your help is going to come in, because in some ways these ancient histories don't immediately seem like they reach into our world. And so let's see what we can do to make that happen, to make that reach possible. I think it's there. In fact, I'm going to talk about a movie produced by a company whose name I will not name in our time, but a movie you may well know. So let's consider a few things. Let me tell you, one of the reasons why I struggle, I'm a history teacher, and I struggle with this part of the Bible, I readily confess. I'm probably less familiar with the history section than I am with any other part of the Bible. That's just an odd confession, I know. I'm much more comfortable in the prophets than I am here. And some of it is just, I started late, and I just haven't sorted out all the places. For example, I've got a list for you of those four names that appear in our chapters tonight. And if you want extra credit, you can help me. Can you sort those people out? And if you can, you're probably ahead of me. I knew it when I made the list, I knew it. But it fades pretty quickly for me, so I'm going to. And again, if we don't figure that out at all, that's all right. There are other things we can conclude, but that's at least those names that look quite a bit alike are part of our work tonight. So if somebody at some point, maybe right now, this is one of those things you could work on if you want to be distracted from other things that are going on, you can take this on as your own research project. So I'm just going to ask you, tell me something that you noted as you read these chapters. Maybe, did he assign these chapters so you knew to read them? Okay. I don't know. So, well, that may be asking too much, but I will nonetheless. Is there a notice of a person, an event, a thing that you want to mention? Just something that you observed as you passed along? Any takers? Brother Barker.
Well, in verse 14, it talks about Rehoboam and the shield that he put out after the Egyptians took the real stones that Solomon made.
You're in chapter 14?
Yes.
And verse 14. That's an odd little incident. I'm glad you brought it up, because I didn't know what to do with it. Go ahead. The shields being talked about there. Keep going.
Well, it's just kind of shows the artificial nature, trying to duplicate or in his own way create what God had created for Solomon. And it was a pale comparison to what came from God.
Okay. All right, thank you. So Brother Barker has noted, one, he's used this word. This is his kind of assessment word. He calls it artificial. And it is, and it's a pale version of what God had done for Solomon. And so let's look, and there are two things. I think two, what are the two things that suggest that the shields are, well, represent a decline, a falling off of that language? Maybe we just need to read the verses aloud to get them in front of us here. Any takers? Be careful, you'll start sounding like my world history class. Just very quiet. Okay, we're in chapter 14, and we're looking at verse 14. And, pardon me. You said verse 25. Okay. In the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against him, and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He took away everything. He also took away all the shields. So notice the third time, a taking away. There's a stripping. There's a bearing of this place. Also took away the shields of gold that Solomon had made. And King Rehoboam made in their place shields of bronze and committed them to the hands of the officers of the guard who kept the door of the king's house. And as often as the king went into the house of the Lord, the guard carried them and brought them back to the guard room. So there are two things, it seems to me, and I wasn't sure how to think about the second one, actually. So what do you see there? What does it show? We've got a change that's happened when you go from the world of Solomon to the world of Rehoboam. There's a downgrade, but be specific. What is the downgrading?
Gold to bronze.
Gold to bronze is one. Sure, it is a less exalted metal. That's one. The second one is a little more intriguing. It's the this hauling them around. What does that suggest? Is that what it is? Okay, thank you. Afraid that someone would take them away. And again, I readily confess, I was working to make sense out of it. So it is, it's in the hands of the guard, went into the house of the Lord, the guard carried them and brought them back to the guard room. It's, I don't know. So is it just a sign of kind of an insecurity and instability, as Brother Royalty suggests, that may well be right. Right? But at any rate, you see, this that had been kind of sacred and set apart and made special is no longer so, or at least less so than it had been. Thank you, Brother Barker. Again, I hope you notice that one of the ways we benefit is by puzzling over these odd little details, they tell us something. Anyone else? What are these? They're in the text. Idols. Now, there's some question about, here it seems to be that they're talking about the actual object that represents a female goddess. It could be the goddess herself being considered, or is it the object? And you get the idea that it is, at least we're talking about things that are being made to honor this idol. Right? And that seems to be one of the prevailing elements that's at work here. And by the way, this actually bears a relation to the lesson this morning. The land thrives when the king is responsive to God and the people too. But I would suggest to you that That's true in other things. For Shakespeare, in his plays, when the king is healthy in mind and body, the kingdom is healthy. And when he's not, when his mind is off, the kingdom is off. And in that movie where there's a lion, remember that the land flourishes when one lion is in charge, and when his brother takes over, the land languishes, right? You understand, that's even children's shows recognize that same thing. And so, but here, what we see, this is how it's different from this morning, I think, is there are two ways to flourish and two ways to languish, right? We talk particularly this morning about moral flourishing, the just balance. And not, it's at least, if somebody can think of a place in here where that's really an issue, I'd be glad to see it. But I think what we see here, that other source, is my devotion directed truly toward God, or is my devotion directed toward an idol? See, so there are two things that get you into the pit. In a diagram I've used of the pit, the things that get you in the pit are idolatry and injustice, the two eyes. And by the way, if you have junior high or high school children, I've made them draw the diagram repeatedly to get that etched into their minds. Maybe there's some older ones who could remember that. But here again, there are two things that get you into the pit. And in this lesson, this section seems to be the story of kings who turn to Asherim. I think that's a plural, and it's a female Asherah, this female deity, this, and actually a fertility goddess, right? We're going to see that some more. And by the way, fertility is tied to, at least in part, tied to the rain and crops. And so you understand that we're not too far from the time. This will be in Elijah's cycle, and Jeff teaches you about that. Elijah and no rain for 3 years. So that, who controls fertility? Is it your idol, or is it the God of heaven? So that's another topic. And I'll just pose this as a question for you. This is one that maybe to take on the road. And that is simply, we probably aren't too likely to make images, statues. We aren't too likely to craft things of metal or wood or clay, stone, and call that an idol. Not as likely to do that, though there are people that might. But I suggest to you that we're no less prone, no less susceptible to idolatry. And notice here, see, idolatry keeps the land from flourishing. Idolatry wrecks the king, wrecks the land, wrecks the people. And so maybe it's something for us to think about if you like. If you don't like, we won't do it. But at least I'll put that out there for you to think about. What idols lure and invite us in our time? Something just to keep in mind. Okay, does anybody want to tell us one of these? Dale. The first one? The second one. Second one, okay.
He's the son of Jeroboam.
Okay.
And he's sick to start the chapter in 14.
Yes.
Ahijah, the third one.
Third one.
Is the prophet that Jehoram sends his wife to find out about Abijah's health problem.
Right. All right. Where are you going to keep going?
I'll stick with those.
Okay. Thank you.
And Jehoram proposes to trick Ahijah, because Ahijah can't see, but God can.
Right.
And she's coming. She'll try to disguise herself.
Disguise herself for a blind man.
And it absolutely fails.
Right. It's meant to be, a pretty comical scene. And she comes, he knows, right? And notice what, does it say when he first heard the sound of her feet? I think it does. I think at least three times in here, feet make a weird presence, a weird appearance. And I don't know what to make of that again, but I want to think most details are not idle. They suggest something to it. But, so you're right, thank you for that. So here we have, at the very beginning, right, that the first words of the first verse of chapter 14, and number two, Abijah is the son of Jeroboam, and he's sick. Right? And there is a prophet, Ahijah, number three on the list. And so the king hopes I can get an encouraging word from the prophet. Right, this tells you the state of the land, though, that there is no hope. In fact, this let me see the I'm in verse 6. When Ahijah heard the sound of her feet, he knew it was her, right? He couldn't see her, and he knew she was coming, so when the sound of someone arriving, he knew it was her. But it's the sound of her feet that gave her away. And he tells her, when you go home, when your feet cross the threshold, second time feet come in, the moment your feet cross the threshold, your son will die. Well, foot.
And he will be buried, and he will be the only yes. male descendant of yours that will be buried.
Yes, so what will be the fate of the rest? Dogs and birds. The rest of your family will be eaten by dogs and eaten by birds. It's pretty specific and pretty grotesque, but that is the fate. They won't even get the burial that others get. Even bad, some of the bad guys get, at least they get buried and they sleep with the fathers. But here, Abijah dies young, but he dies before the rest of his family is eaten by dogs, right? And we're even told why. That's another, we'll come back to that. There, verse 13 of chapter 14. God tells you why that he's going to die and get buried is because there's something pleasing about him. And the implication is there's nothing pleasing about anyone else. It does not mean he lives a long life. It means he escapes some of the tragedy. So here again, this is a thoroughgoing ruin of a family, thoroughgoing ruin, rejection, judgment on a family because of what they do. Go ahead. Thank you. Yes, there's a cataloging, in fact, here. Now, the way that's not grammatically correct. These are words spoken to Jeroboam, not said about, it's about him, but they're spoken to him. That's why it says, you have done this. You have gone and made, and you have cast me behind your back, God says. You've turned to other gods and turned away from me. You understand that is the repeated experience of the children of Israel persistent return to idolatry. Remember, Hosea marries a harlot who turns away from him, is unfaithful to him, because God wants him to experience what he's experienced. Yes, Harold.
chosen Jeroboam to be the king over Israel, over the 10 tribes. But Jeroboam, you know, turned out to be, turned Israel away from God, basically.
Right.
It seems that his son that we're talking about, Abijah, I guess, may have been born. You remember Jeroboam had gone in, fled into Egypt when Solomon was king. And it's possible that that's where he was born, because his name means Jehovah is my father. So he would have been born at a time that Jeroboam was devoted to God in some form or fashion.
Okay.
And so he would have been raised, perhaps, in that kind of environment. Now that Jeroboam has turned against God, and keep in mind that the Jews in Babylon are reading this, and they're saying, okay, there's Israel, we know about Israel. God chose Jeroboam, but now almost immediately God turns against Jeroboam, and he says, I'm turning against you, I'm turning against your family, but your one son, who has found favor in my eyes, he's going to die, but we're all going to die, but he's going to be buried. The rest of your family is not. So God is telling the Jews in Babylon, he's helping them to see that the idolatry that struck Israel only lasted another, 200 years. But God took them down, and he's showing them that this idolatry, it affected Israel, and you were only spared by the grace of God as long as you were. The fact that you served idols and came back and served idols again, came back to me, and that back and forth time, he said, finally, they should have learned the lesson from the kings, this history, that, yeah, this is why we're here. We did like Jeroboam did, and we deserved everything that we've gotten.
Thank you. We benefit. Harold's robust voice, I'm sure you, pretty good for a retired guy, I'd say. Harold gives you the benefit of having heard things from Jeff, this perspective from captivity is a way to see what's going on here. So it is a history lesson, and in fact, maybe it was one of the lessons for us is to think about the lessons of our own history, and we understand why we are where we are today. And I don't, on some of that, we could think about that as a national level, but we can also think about it as a congregational level. And how the way we are is the result of the free choice of individuals. Because Jeroboam didn't have to fail, right? At least I'm assuming that God gives us, to some extent, not absolutely, but to some extent, free will, the ability to choose. And Jeroboam made choices, and the people under him suffered for those choices. So thank you for that. So this is the lesson that the captives should be considering as they ponder these stories. Thank you. Yes. Or he becomes the standard of badness.
Yes.
Thank you. But also, Vicki mentions the gifts that are brought to Ahijah, and part of this trying to get from him. Because as Vicki notes, he is known to be a true prophet, and yet they're still trying to work the prophet here by disguise and by gifts, and 10 loaves, 10 tribes, maybe not a coincidence there. All right, thank you. Again, you're drawing things together from your work, and I appreciate that so very much. I want to, once again, I keep looking for the verbs, but I forgot to list where I got these. So this is what God says to about Jeroboam. I gave you, I did these things for you. I'm the one who exalted you. I made you. I tore the kingdom away from David's family, and I gave it to you. This is pretty vigorous verbs about here. You were nothing, and I made you something. And you had an opportunity, and you blew Wheaties. If you want me to explain what that means, I will. But you had a choice, and you chose, you missed this opportunity. You forsook the opportunity because of these temptations. So let's go and keep going and see if we found some. Here, what Rehoboam did, and it's similar in some ways. And we're told that these two men warred the whole time, and that's another sign of some turning away from God, is that wars and rumors of wars are around. So what did Rehoboam do? He built high places, he built pillars, and he built Asherim also. So these are all objects, sites, and that show that they're creating opportunities and places for cult worship, for idol worship again, and even here the use of male cult prostitutes, again, fertility ceremonies that would have been grossly offensive to God. And so here we see, you know, in both parts, there is this kind of piling on of badness going here. In fact, this is some of the language that gets used in the prophets repeatedly. On every high hill and under every green tree. I remember reading those words with students in this church in fifth grade class 40 years ago. And that's just it's everywhere. These sacred places that you've made that are so important to you. And here again, I'm asking you to wonder, do we have counterparts today? Not exactly the same, but are there something? So again, is for something to take on the road for us is to, one of those would be to ponder the idolatry that's still lurks. If there is a lesson, I think, it has to be that the temptations that these people encounter aren't any different from ours. The nature of humans is still at least somewhat consistent, somewhat continuous with their nature. And so this temptation to idolatry is still with us. It takes a new form, perhaps. And in fact, a form that maybe not so conspicuous, that there's no object we could kick or stumble over.
Randy, I'll give you an example of something we have in this country that fits that kind of a description, and that's lotteries. You can find them virtually from one end of the country to the other.
On every high hill and under. All right. I hadn't thought of that one, Dale, so thank you. Lotteries as a... As someone called them, lotteries are a tax on people who can't do math. Think about that. Okay, well, or thank you. I appreciate a specific example, and we could go on. We'll look at some other ones as well if you And probably that's one of those phenomena that's not brand new, but it certainly has become more widespread. And that's Dale's main point there, is that ubiquitousness. That word just spread out everywhere too, didn't it? And so, all right, so that's part of that's an example. Thank you. Let's consider some other ones. And now let's come to this person, Asa. One of the ways that you notice, if you look at you could look online and find a list of kings. Asa's a king for a long time. And so he actually overlaps with seven kings, at least a little bit, seven kings of Israel. You don't know this, again, you can't say this for sure, but there may be some correlation between his longevity and his faithfulness to God. I can't say that for sure. But he lasts a lot longer than the seven-day king, right? Which one was that? Zimri, I think it was. They seem like they get shorter and shorter in their reign and their tenure. But look at this list of verbs. He did all these things. So let's find, where is Asa? Somebody can help me out. Here we are with chapter 15. 15 and beginning in about, if we look in verse 11, in a contrast to Vicky's observation that Jeroboam is the standard of badness, but here in verse 11 we see that there's another standard, the standard of David. Right? He's mentioned repeatedly in these three chapters, and with a little bit of variation each time. And one time, in fact, it even mentions he's wholly a man after God's heart, except that time with, right, Bathsheba. But in verse 11, I'm in chapter 15 of 1 Kings, and Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. There's the test. See, what do the eyes of the Lord show? What do the eyes of the Lord see? And here he did what was right. And that, in that sense, you see, he is fulfilling God's right order for a king, for a people, for a land, for a time. But notice it's not about just balances. That's just not talked about. It's about devotion to God. So those are the two, the idolatry and injustice. And here we're dwelling on the idolatry part. And look what he did. He put away, first one, he put away the cult prostitutes out of the land and removed all the idols his fathers had made. So he cleared the junk. And then, verse 13, he also removed his mother from being queen mother because she had made an abominable image of Asherah, and Asa cut down her image and burned it at the brook Kidron. So a list. Then we skip to verse 15, and he brought into the house of the Lord the sacred gifts of his father and his own sacred gifts. So this seems to put him, again, different from the guy who had to live with the stripped-down holy place because the Egyptians had taken it away, and all he could do is bring his bronze shields kind of temporarily. So that's another kind of restoring. So Asa is a restorationist, right? Because he's lured, he has this high vision of doing things God's way. And it makes you wonder how he got that vision. And what can we do to get and keep that same vision? Let's go back to, I skipped a verse 14, because I wanted you to see this word. Watch for the but when you read. There's a qualification, there's an exception, there's the other side. And here, but the high places were not taken away. So there is a recognition that the lottery's still there. Other things have been taken away, but something's still there. Those high places. On every high hill and under every green tree, some of the things still remain. So there is a qualification, and yet the next sentence, nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly true to the Lord all his days. There's the test. And I promise you, ladies and gentlemen, it's a test for us. He missed an opportunity on a certain practice here. He didn't remove the high places, but his heart is true. And so maybe, and again, I don't excuse any wrongdoing, but it is true here that the but is present, and the writer says his heart was true to God. And so that seems to be the test for us. What is the condition of our hearts that drives our actions? Remember the language of Ephesians 1, may the eyes of your heart be enlightened, right? So you can see rightly to do rightly, as we've been talking. Okay, question, comment about Asa or related thing. Before you say that, let me give you this caution. If I run out of soap, which is quite likely, you can certainly fill in and talk for me, but if you can't talk anymore, we'll still go to the end. All I'll do is start reading the next chapter and give you a head start on your homework, and we'll just start reading in chapter 17 and help you start thinking about the things that Jeff will teach you about. I won't try to teach anything from there. We'll just read it if we come to that. Maybe you'll see that as a threat. Maybe you'll see that. Let's just keep quiet and the guy will start reading. So I'm happy to go either way about that. Please understand that this, though, is the measure. Asa's heart is said to be wholly true. Let it be said of us. Harold.
It's interesting in the Chronicles account of Asa that it presents a little bit different picture. I mean, in terms of this, it's true. But there's the aspect of Asa later on in his life where Baasha,
right.
And so rather than seeking God's help and going to God and asking God to do what needs to be done with respect to Israel, he makes an alliance, forms an alliance with the king of Damascus. And the prophet of God came to Asa and said, what in the world are you doing?
Yeah.
You had God and you're right there and you didn't even think to go to God for help.
Right.
And because you just decided to take it upon yourself to do it your way, not seek God's help. You know, Damascus, you're going to lose the gold that you're given from the treasuries
right.
to the king of Damascus, and you're going to lose to the king of Damascus as well. You're going to lose his support. And then later in his life, the same Asa seems to take matters in his own hands as well. He got a disease in his feet, I think, which he eventually died from. But rather than seeking God's help in that, he again seeks the help of physicians, the doctors. And so, to me, it's an important lesson. It goes back to, I think, what you were saying, is that Asa was like David. He was not a perfect man. Mm-hmm. We think of David as being, you know, a man after God's own heart. He never had sin in his life. Well, that's silly. And the same thing is true with Asa. You know, these were men that had blind spots. They had their own demons. They had their own temptations, they had their own foibles, and yet God could say regarding Asa, his heart was wholly true to me. You know, Romans 6:16, he had yielded himself to be a servant of God. He had volunteered himself to serve God. That doesn't mean that he didn't sin, but it meant that was the direction he was going towards God at all times, and God honored that.
Thank you, Harold. Notice Harold's method. That in itself is a useful method reminder. Get the Chronicles version and play them against each other and see what benefit comes from reading comparatively there. So thank you for that. But some of that's talked about here, right? Some of his desire to make deals with nearby rulers rather than God. And by the way, as I was listening to your helpful elaboration, I couldn't help but think of our time and the temptation to join ourselves to politics. I didn't say which way to join. I would say either one, and multiple ways, maybe beyond those two, seems to at least flirt with this same problem, that we're looking for our answer from men and not from God. We forget the lesson of this, you know, the lesson of Gideon. The battle belongs to the Lord, and we're determined no, or it's like Abraham, right, and Sarah. We're gonna get this child that God wants us to have. We're gonna get him our way, rather than depending on God. So it is a sustained pattern through the Bible, time after time, way after way, of people thinking with good intentions, perhaps, we're gonna help God. He had a good idea, but he just needs our help. We just need a basketball court, and then right next to the lottery store. So, okay. But again, the examples we could argue about particular examples, but I'm very grateful for that. Notice also Harold mentioned this third reference to feet. Is it just an idle mention to say that Asa gets a disease in his feet that kills him? And I don't know what to make of it. But I think I make more of it now when I listen to what Harold's saying. Is that in some ways, and here again, there's a typological exercise going on. I hope you, as Hunter so ably presented this morning, the first Passover was a type for something that was to come later. And in some ways, the king in his body is reflecting the health of the kingdom. And when his feet are diseased, he's not wholly sick. His feet are diseased. I don't know if there's what to be made of that. I'll just leave it to you. You can ask Jeff next week, and he'll explain it all to you, I'm sure. So thank you for that good addition. It should give us some comfort to know that we can be wholly true to God without being, and we can actually be perfect. In one sense of that word, we can be whole and complete. That's the sense of perfect, without being without error. You know, there is a difference there. We tend to take that word one way, and maybe we'd benefit if we could kind of understand the word more in the Bible sense of it. Okay, here, We're getting, at the very end, we just meet that guy, right? The guy you'll be dwelling on for a while, Ahab. So remember what I said, Asa rules so long that he overlaps with seven kings of Israel. And Ahab comes to the throne of Israel while Asa is still alive, but only the last very little while. I don't remember exactly the number of years, but not very many. Right? And so the story of Ahab is joined in here. And of course, he's going to become legendary. So let's just look at the text here. I'm in chapter 16 now. About three years before his death. I'm in chapter 16 and I'm in verse 29. Join me there, please. We're in 1 Kings 16, verse 29. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, he reigns there 41 years, so he's got 3 years to go, thereabouts, Ahab, the son of Omri, began to reign over Israel. And Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel and Samaria 22 years. Now, that may challenge my notion. That's a pretty long rule for a king as bad as he was. And Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. And as if, this is what I've got here, and as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. See there, that's Vicky's language. See, walk the way Jeroboam walked. That's the test. He thought that was no big deal, and now look what happens. He compounds that by doing this. He took for his wife, there she is. Nobody in here ever thought of naming their daughter Jezebel, right? You just don't do it. Oh, don't tell me afterwards you have an aunt named Jezebel. I don't want to hear it. When you get to the, okay, well, let's hope not. He took for his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal. Notice the end of his name, Baal. We'll talk about that in just a minute. In the, and served Baal, or Baal, and worshiped him. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. And Ahab made an Asherah. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. In his days, Hiel of Bethel built Jericho. He laid its foundation at the cost of Abiram. Oh, there's another one of our A guys, his firstborn. I'm not sure what it means. He built the city at the cost of a son. He built the foundation. Set up his gates at the cost of his youngest son. I'm not sure what that means. But here again, it is a human cost being paid by these people. But there's the third of the four A guys. And so this, we end the chapter with this introduction of not just Ahab's presence, but his evil and his marrying this woman whose father, and by the way, this is something, let me see, that's our, what did I just do? Oh man, what am I doing now? There's no hope. Okay, it's okay, I was gonna go back. I had the word Baal up there at an earlier time. Baal just literally means Lord. That's what it means. And so in and of itself, it's not necessarily a troublesome word, but it becomes intrinsically associated with idol worship. Maybe different gods than the Asherim, but essentially the same kind of Semitic fertility gods. And here, building temples, idols, houses for such gods. So that we end this three-chapter section back where we began with this celebration of idolatry. And here, if you're reading this in captivity, the lesson you learn is that we are, we tend toward idols. So we captives. But the question is, do we do the same? I want to go back and mention, there we are, all right. Let me just show you just one other slide along, somewhere along the way. Two verbs that seem to be just at the heart of all of these. The really wonderful language, and David used it in his comments before the Lord's Supper last week, I believe. This king slept with his fathers. That's a lovely sound. Instead of saying he died, he slept with his fathers. That's nice language. That's the ending of all of the good guys, bad guys. As Harold says, they all die, they sleep with the fathers. But before they slept, they walked. And how did they walk? That's our language of the common practice of our lives. We've seen it again and again in different ways. Let's pray together as we come to a close. Thank you for your good help in kind of filling in and helping to shape this material based on things you've talked about before. Holy God, help us to be your people. Help us to know that we can choose. We can choose to walk your way. We can choose to tear down the idols. We can choose right devotion to you. And we can seek health in our homes and in our families and our congregation here and as our land as a whole as we bring your worship to the fore. Help us to learn. Help us to be your people. We thank you for your words, and we thank you not only for them by themselves, but your words considered together here in the company of a people who try so very hard to be wholly true to you. Help that be true. Help us to be yours wholeheartedly. We thank you now in the name of Jesus. Amen.